When I was pitching, I had Bob Gibson up there on the wall. When I first met him, away from the game, I tried to introduce myself, and he was having none of it.
Oh, wow.
And so first time I got up, he struck me out. He was old, but he still had a nasty slider. Yeah. So he struck me out. I was cool when people saw me on the field, but I got in that tunnel. God, that was up. You know? And so people wondered what was up. So later in the game, same two strikes, same pitch. I went down and got it. I hit like a two iron out of left center field. Took my time around the bases looking at him all the way, walked across home plate, pointed my finger and said, I'm here too. And wow. I walked toward the dugout and the guy said to me, man, you crazy, that Bob Gibson, later for Bob Gibson. Next time I came up, first two pitches right at my head, but I was too quick. I was too quick. They took him out of the game. But there I said, maybe I belong. If I can hit Bob Gibson, you know, and that's who I wanted to be.
Every Hall of Famer has experienced it. Every MVP has gone through it. Every All-Star has endured it. It is a unifying experience amongst all professional athletes, the perennial superstars, and the ones who couldn't quite grasp it. For some, it is a memory they hold dear and remember with great nostalgia. For others, it was a horror show they would love to forget. But for every single professional athlete, it's the one thing they all have in common. Rookie year.
Today's guest is Dave Winfield. Born and raised in Minnesota, Dave is a former American baseball player who crushed records everywhere during his 22-year career, becoming a 12-time Major League All-Star, 7-time Gold Glove winner, 6-time Silver Slugger Award winner. Dave earned his spot in the Baseball Hall of Fame and has been named the third best all-time athlete in any sport by ESPN. Mr. Dave Winfield, I am beyond excited, man, to have you on. Kind of a funny background story besides how great of a player you were. Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Your wife is had nice enough to ask what the meal we were having with my girlfriend at the time. And now me and you are friends.
Yeah, absolutely. We were having a nice dinner, sitting next to each other. I said, I know this brother. And you were saying the same thing. I know him, but we didn't say anything until the women started talking about, what kind of wine is that?
Yeah, that's what I'm
talking
about.
And then we engaged in a conversation. So, you know, I appreciate it. You know, so I followed you for years. We never had a chance to talk. You know, we've both been in the professional sports, done a lot of different things outside of the sport.
Yep.
So I'm glad to be able to talk to you. Whatever you want to touch on.
All right, so the show is Rookie Year. And okay, what I try to focus on is just to transition from being an amateur athlete to professional. Mm-hmm. And I think that your story was so compelling that you got drafted by all three sports.
Yeah,
so,
professionally, yeah.
Yeah, professionally. I mean, professionally, you got drafted. You know, so you're one of the greatest collegiate athletes of all time. Because some people can hang their hat on that. And that's, I mean, touch on that. What was that like to be able to kind of have your pick? Obviously, baseball was your first love, but.
Well, how about this? You know, first of all, Jared, you and I are both Big Ten graduates. We come out of that, you know, tough Big Ten.
Yeah.
I was up in Minnesota. I went there on a baseball scholarship, knowing that's what I was going to play. I said, I'm going to play one more year of basketball, just freshman basketball. So mm-hmm. We had some good guys coming in, people that ultimately went pro, Jim Brewer,
yep.
Ron Behagen, guys like this. So I said, I'm going to play one more year. So I did that, sat out the second year. We played intramural ball, mm-hmm. had the best team in the school, you know. It was called Soulful Strutters. Yeah. How about that? And so we used to kind of beat up on the rookies coming in, the kids, freshmen. Mm-hmm. And then Bill Musselman and his coaches said, you should play for the varsity. I said, I'm not into it. I'm going to play baseball. Long and short of that, they said, we'll give you a full basketball scholarship. Took the basketball scholarship, still played baseball.
Yeah.
And, you know, when 15, 17,000 people see you a day, your athleticism and everything, baseball was flourishing for me. Basketball all of a sudden just exploded for me. And then the Minnesota Vikings at the end of, you know, my collegiate career said, you could play tight end for us.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so today it would kind of really blow up the internet. But uh-huh. back then there was none. But I was drafted in all the sports. I chose the one that I wanted to play, which was baseball, from 10, 12 years old.
Yeah.
And I respect and appreciate the others, but I did what I wanted to do.
And go back, people might not know, you were a dominant pitcher.
Oh, yeah.
So your athleticism, baseball now is so different. You know, back then you played, you know, you would bat and you would pitch, and it wasn't that unheard of. Mm-hmm. So you were kind of that last generation of that. You were a dominant pitcher.
Yeah, I mean, from growing up, I just you do everything.
Yeah.
Athlete, you know, you play all sports, all seasons.
Yep.
And if you're an athlete, you know, I played shortstop, I pitched, all of that. So I go to college and they just wanted me to pitch.
Mm-hmm.
They were real, and my friends used to come to the game, put Winfield in the game, he's the best hitter you got. You know, but I kept pitching, and last year they let me hit. The long and short of it is they College World Series, my last year.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the MVP of the College World Series as a pitcher and a hitter. And then when I was drafted, they said, what do you want me to do? They said, we want you to play every day and hit.
Yeah.
So I had a long journey to kind of figure out to improve on my skills, because I wasn't a finished product as a hitter in the big leagues, because for 3 years, they didn't let me hit.
That's crazy.
And so, infinite wisdom of college coaches. Huh?
I mean, you end up being, you know, a Hall of Famer and doing that, and you didn't hit for 3 years?
Didn't hit for 3 years. And in college, I went to, during the summer, we had a collegiate league that went to Alaska.
Uh-huh.
And I had a great coach up there. His name was Jim Dietz. He was with San Diego State. And we played a lot of great competition, but they let me pitch and hit.
Gotcha.
And so I didn't completely lose those skills, but you know, it's tough. You can't just not pitch or not hit for a long time. So I had once I made it to the professional ranks, I had a lot to learn. And I was aware of that. And, you know, some people think they got it made. They know what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, I'm All-American, first-round draft pick. Nah, I shut my mouth. Listened to the veterans and was in awe of some of the people, because there were some great people playing. I mean, you can ask me, but I mean, Willie Mays was still playing.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that a little bit, man. Like, obviously, when you walk out there and Willie Mays is still playing and all these guys you looked up to, was he like the person you saw and you were like, man, you know?
Yeah. I was, Hank Aaron was still playing.
That's crazy.
These guys were like baseball gods to me.
Yeah.
You know, even though once we go professional, you still looked up to people before you.
For sure.
You respected them for what they accomplished and what they meant. And when I was coming up, baseball was still the number one sport in America.
Yeah.
Young people don't know. It wasn't basketball.
Yep.
It wasn't football. They never thought the Super Bowl would succeed.
Yeah.
So these guys were pinned to my wall in college. When I was pitching, I had Bob Gibson up there on the wall, you know, with this follow through on that one leg, looking very athletic.
Yeah.
And when I was hitting, I had Willie McCovey pinned to the wall.
Okay.
And another Hall of Famer. Not that they weren't Hall of Famers then, they were still playing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's who I wanted to emulate. And Willie McCovey became my teammate years later, and he looked out for me. He put his arm around me, come on, young man, and took care of me. So I always respected and appreciated that.
No, I mean, it is, man. It's so crazy that you look back on those first few years, or that first year you walk in that locker room,
mm-hmm.
and you're just, it's like being in high school again. Like, you're praying for that one veteran to like come over there and be nice to you, because if they're not, it's like, that's a lonely feeling. Who was that veteran guy that, you know, your rookie year that really put his arm around you and was like, come on, young fella, I got you?
On my team, there were a couple of guys, a couple of brothers, actually. Cito Gaston.
Okay.
People know him from being the manager of the Blue Jays winning, but Cito was there, and there was a guy named Nate Colbert who looked out for me. I mean, I looked up to these guys, and, you know, they were veterans. They weren't, you know, necessarily Hall of Fame players, but they were people I could relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And they shared information with me. The next year, Cito Gaston, actually, we were roommates for a short period of time. And then almost 20 years later, he's the manager of a team, and I'm one of his star players. So you never know what path, you know, they're going to follow in sports. But those guys on my team, other teams, I talked to other players, and I appreciate them. There was like a Billy Williams,
mm-hmm.
who was ended up being a Hall of Fame player, but he was with the Cubs at the time. I respected him.
Yeah.
you know, there were a number of players. Tony Perez, I talked to on the other team because I wanted to be an RBI guy.
Yeah.
And he was the man. Yeah. He doggy. Yes, you know, the Cincinnati Reds, big red machine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they were kicking everyone's butt. I said, I gotta figure out what to do.
Yeah.
So he was helpful.
That's awesome, man. And the money in baseball, how much has that changed? I mean, like, right? I mean.
Oh, so much.
When you look back, you know, we have like rough numbers here. When you look at signing a deal for, you know, 5-6 figures, which you did, it was a big deal back then.
Uh-huh.
And now you look at guys that like their signing bonuses, you know, $5 million, $10 million mm-hmm. on just minor league deals.
Yeah.
Like you went right to the majors.
I did. But back then, and people have to understand the evolution of all the sports.
Yeah.
Basketball was making less than, I'm going to tell you what we were making in a second. Football was making less.
Yeah.
And you're going to get hurt.
Yes.
Permanently.
For sure.
I'm going to tell you what it was. Rookie salary in 1973,
uh-huh.
professional baseball,
mm-hmm.
$15,000. Average salary, $36,000. Top salary, maybe $150,000, and I wasn't Hank Aaron.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And there were no multi-year contracts.
Just single-year deals.
No free agency. No arbitration.
Who changed
pension was terrible.
And who changed all that?
Players Union.
Players Union.
Players Union. And the Baseball Players Union was a leader
yes.
in that respect. Unions today, people may say they're on the wane and everything, but they're very critical because I work for the Players Association
yeah.
today. I'm an advisor to the top guy, Tony Clark.
Yep.
And I always tell the young players coming up because they think, oh, now we make a minimum $550,000. Average is about $4 million.
Mm-hmm.
Top, $35 million. Mike Trout getting $400-something million over his career. And so, you know, people look at it like monopoly money, but it wasn't always like that.
Yeah.
And they didn't get it without sacrifice by many, many people before them. I have to say that being a union member and a strong advocate and I was out of work. There was a work stoppage 5 times in my career.
Well, your career was also 22 years now. So.
Yeah, but it was in the first. It was up
yeah,
front
yeah, yeah.
before ownership said, you know what, man? These guys are serious. They
yeah.
stick together. Otherwise, you'd still be making what they make in the minor leagues today without representation.
Yeah, I mean, baseball probably is close to the strongest unions in the country. I mean, you broke the Teamsters, you broke a bunch of the other big auto unions and, you know, steel workers. The baseball players union is powerful. And and they kind of set the mold and the model for the rest of professional sports. I mean, I know in basketball, we follow kind of the trend of what baseball's done. Football's not near as strong.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, baseball providing a lifestyle and a life after playing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you guys probably were in the forefront of that, of helping retired players.
Absolutely. You know, we could spend a whole series on that, but
yeah.
Marvin Miller, we were very fortunate
yep.
to have a gentleman. He's no longer with us, but Marvin Miller was a leader, guiding force behind what the players accomplished. In his soft-spoken voice, but very knowledgeable background, Steelworkers Union and such,
yep.
players said, he said, no matter what to get a fair and equitable deal, you just have to stick together. Know what is right, what is fair. Stick together, go for it, and you can accomplish it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very interesting to go through that period of time in the industry when we had nothing.
Yeah.
And we're treated like any way we want it. And a few years before that, Curt Flood was pretty much, you know, they took yeah. away his career. He said, you're treating me like chattel.
Yeah.
I've been around a long time. I don't want to go to this team in a trade. They said, well, go home.
Yep.
And he did. And
that was
just a few years before that.
That was it.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll go back a little bit. Who do you think kind of was the biggest person in your professional life? Like, was it your father? Was it a coach? Like, who was the person that kind of left the biggest imprint on your professional playing career?
I had a youth coach for a handful of years. His name was Billy Peterson. Bill Peterson. He's still alive today, St. Paul, Minnesota.
Okay.
I think he instilled the basic fundamentals and foundations of how to, not only how to play the game, but what kind of person to be.
Yeah.
What kind of mental approach you play, bring to the game. No excuses. You know, just how you deal with your teammates, how you deal with the opposition. And that stuck with me. And one of the just small things they teach you, it was always, I want you to attack the ball. So, Jared, when you see any videotape of me,
yeah,
I'm kind of buggy whipping that ball. You know, they're bringing it in
there.
And I'm like, yeah. I'm trying to knock somebody's glove off.
Yeah.
You know?
It is crazy. And a little background for everybody listening. You're one of my favorite players of all time because of my dad. And I told you that when we talked that night.
Uh-huh.
You're sitting next to me. And I was like, man, please let this guy talk to me. And it was so cool to be able to call my dad like the next morning and be like, Dad, I met Dave Winfield and do that. Did you ever think growing up that you would have this kind of impact, a generational impact on, you know, young men and women?
No. Because it wasn't there. It wasn't a reality. I grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota in the 50s. And, you know, today, they're trying to throw us back to the 50s.
Yeah.
I mean, things are happening in society. You'd think it's like the 50s. So there weren't that many role models out there, accomplished people. You think maybe one key doctor in the community or business person.
Mm-hmm.
There were no Oprah Winfrey's. There were no Robert Smith's. You know, I mean, people succeeding either in economically, socially.
Politically.
Yeah. It wasn't there. So I just was pursuing what my passion was, baseball. It was fun. It was good. And by 12 years old, I said, I want to do that.
Yeah.
So I far exceeded anything in my family in terms of income, travel, all those kinds of things. And, you know, I mean, there was no one with a foundation as a professional athlete before me.
Yep.
So when I started that, subsequently, everybody does that today.
Yeah.
I didn't know I was on the tip of the spear, the cutting edge, but guys like, I helped Arthur Ashe create one. Derek Jeter, I find out later on.
Yeah.
I was his inspiration to do it. Martina Navratilova. I could go down a list, but there are so many things that I did. The travel. I mean, I traveled the world.
Yeah.
Met presidents of countries. Earned income. I was making more money with that little lightweight money that they paid me professionally than my mother ever made at her peak in her career. And I was the parents were divorced. So I was the person kind of leading the way, opening the eyes, even for my own family and community.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it is, man. I think that people forget how close we are to segregation, you know, and to open segregation and two Jim Crow laws. I mean, my dad was born in 1940 in Roanoke, Fort, Mississippi. You know, so he was down there and he remembers his parents handpicking cotton. So you figure one generation, my dad's same way. My dad's traveled the world with me. We've gone everywhere. And that's one thing, as much criticism as we have about sports, it gives you that. You know, it's giving you the chance to meet presidents, meet world leaders, provide a foundation that you probably couldn't have done any other way. I mean, what other way was it for an African-American to make it out in the 50s? Was there any other way?
No, not really. I mean, you could see on TV, oh, wow, there's Nat King Cole. We got a black entertainer on television. Or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everybody was the first.
Yeah.
You know, everybody was the first. And so, you know, people today sometimes take things for granted. I've always told my kids, don't take it for granted, man.
Yeah, nah.
You're not that far away from the way things used to be.
Nah, it's still super, super close.
Yeah.
So real quick, going back to your rookie season, San Diego.
Yes.
You're coming from the tundra. I mean, honestly, Minneapolis is the coldest place on the planet.
It's cold, man.
I mean, boy.
It's beautiful in the summer.
No, it is, though. I mean, in the summertime, I mean, that place is gorgeous. It's great. But if you didn't have those tunnels downtown, you'd freeze to death.
Right,
I mean, it's too cold out there. And now you go to San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a culture shock? What was the kind of atmosphere for that, for you to go from freezing cold to beautiful Southern California?
I had seen Southern California because my dad, who, even though the parents were divorced, he worked for an airline and get those free tickets once in a while. I'd take a little trip on the side. And so I'd seen Southern California. I said, this is nice. Yeah, man, this is nice. But so I went to San Diego. Comparatively, it was much more sleepy and small than it is today.
Yeah.
Than you would look at it. But going there and going right to the big leagues, no minor league experience.
Yeah.
So I didn't know a lot of people at all. You know, guys come from the minor leagues and they know a dozen or couple dozen people they played against or with. So I knew maybe two guys I'd played against during the summer league up in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were teammates. And how about this? I have to tell you, I get out there, it's much different than it is today. Even with bonus money, I had never owned a car. I'm 20 years old.
It's crazy.
And I'm in San Diego, don't own a car, have to stay in a motel, have to hitch a ride with one of the guys in the motel to go to the ballpark each day. And I have to give credit, and I looked him up after many years, a guy that you don't, people wouldn't know his name from playing. His name was Dwayne Anderson.
Okay.
He was a backup infielder. He said, hey, big man, I see you struggling to get to the ballpark each day. Why don't you stay with me?
Yeah.
So in Mission Valley, close to the ballpark, he had a one-bedroom place. He stayed in the living room, let me use his bedroom, and he would drive me in his little Z240, whatever, to the ballpark. I appreciated that to the day. After that season, I ultimately got my first car.
Yeah.
They had notes on it. It was not like now everybody jump out. Give me that Mercedes or give me that, you know, that another dope car, you know. Give me an Aston Martin. Hey,
something real nice.
As a rookie.
Nothing.
Not back then.
Nah. I mean, did you guys have jobs, like summer jobs in the summer, off season?
Yeah. Yeah. You try to get a little appearance or whatever. I did something with a clothing store, you know. You had to think about that.
Yeah.
Because you didn't make ends meet all year long with what you made. I'm a professional baseball player, 20 years old, but you don't know things about the economy and money.
Yeah.
Who's going to teach me?
Nobody.
And the family.
Yeah.
How about this? The very first year with the San Diego Padres, I have a business advisor in the stock market. He directed me towards some stocks. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I think they're professional. They know what they're doing. By the end of the year, what he invested me in, that's going down.
Yeah.
Number two, I'm with the Padres. The guy that owned the team at the time, his name was C. Arnhold Smith. He's going bankrupt. So the bank that I kept my money in, they said, wait, he's going bankrupt. My money's in the bank. What's up? I didn't know anything about the FDIC at the time where your money's protected.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking I worked all year and put my money in a bank and they're going bankrupt. Where's my money? I'm mad as a...
Yeah.
So everything that you work for
mm-hmm.
was kind of dissipating. It was disappearing. And until they told me, no, Security Pacific is going to take over the bank. Your money is safe. And then I had some money in a bank in Minneapolis, and I'm watching on TV. How about this? During Thanksgiving, I see downtown is on fire.
Oh,
a
God.
Whole block downtown, and my bank is in the middle of it. I'm thinking my money's in the bank. This is honest to God truth. They said, no, no, no. I called up my guy, private banker. He said, no, 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 no. Your money is not in the bank. And I'm thinking, money's not in the bank. And I see. So I learned a lot. One, there was a banker, and I appreciate her to this day. She said, let me take you to lunch and explain some things about finances to you.
Yeah.
And they let me know. I said, things such as, you mean if I can give you money, like CDs at the time were paying good money, you know, certificates of deposit.
Yep.
And they said, you need to have more than just a checking account. You're making no money. And then if you want to borrow money for a car, a boat, a house, they're charging you 8-9% or whatever.
Yeah.
So they're charging me on my money and not paying me anything.
Yep.
Oh, once, what do they say? Once your mind has been expanded, it doesn't go back to where it was before.
Nah, never.
So they taught me some lessons early on, but I thought I was getting whipsawed all over, losing my money, bonus money, that taxes hadn't been paid, banks on fire.
Yeah. I mean, listen,
people bankruptcy.
But it's real. I mean, you come from this background. I was the same way. You come from a background and everyone's like, oh, you didn't know this? You didn't know this? And you almost feel sometimes embarrassed, like, well, no, I didn't know it. And you almost feel embarrassed to ask the questions that you should. And I think that it's a prime example for the whole world right now, especially minorities. Mm-hmm. Ask questions. And I think that you can't be scared to always just ask questions. Like, think about if you would have felt more comfortable asking those questions early on, you could have saved yourself a few months and, you know, a few nights of really worrying about stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, and we would all agree that everyone, professional athlete or people that can't focus on their money all the time, they're going to get nicked. Something's going to happen. Somebody's going to steal. There's going to be a lawsuit. There's the economy is going to change. So no one escapes their life and their finances unscathed. So sometimes,
yeah.
Sometimes things happening to you motivate you. But I'm going to tell you one thing it did for me. I said, nah, no one's going to negotiate a contract for me without me, my input, and me being in the room. So nobody after that did a contract without me being in the room and without my input.
What was your favorite city to play in?
Good question. I mean, I played well against Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a world-class city.
Yeah.
Ended up playing there at one point. Cleveland wasn't a very nice place.
Mm-hmm.
The stadium was awful. It was 80,000. I'm going to tell you, but I would kill them in that stadium.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There were 80,000 seats at the old football stadium for the Browns.
Yep.
10,000 people would be at a game. And the field was always mushy and wet because it didn't drain right. But I could tell my guys, I get up to play, I said, watch what I do to this guy.
And just crush it.
For some reason, I used to kill him in Cleveland.
That's awesome, man. What was that moment that you knew that you belonged in a major? So for me, it's always so funny. For me, it was like I lined up across from Jamal Mashburn. It was like my rookie year. And I was across from Jamal Mashburn.
Kentucky.
Yeah.
Strong.
He was so good. And he gave me like 16 points in like 5 minutes. I went back to the bench. And I was like, they're really good in the NBA. Mom, I can't really play against them. So he busted my butt. But the next night, we played against Boston Celtics and against Paul Pierce. And I had learned so much and I did a really good job defending Paul Pierce. And that was like, all right, cool. Like, I belong moment in the NBA. What was your I belong moment?
Although there were a number of them, because I was seeing pitches that I'd never seen before. There was a guy named Mike Marshall throwing from the Dodgers, throwing a screwball, you know, right-handed throw. I swung at it. I said, I almost wanted to take my helmet out and scratch my head. Where did that pitch go? How did it move like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm going to tell you, one of my heroes, Bob Gibson,
yep.
When I first met him, away from the game, I tried to introduce myself, and he was having none of it.
Oh, wow.
And so first time I got up, he struck me out. He was old, but he still had a nasty slider.
Yeah.
So he struck me out. I was cool when people saw me on the field, but I got in that tunnel. God, that was up. You know? And so people wondered what was up. So later in the game, same two strikes, same pitch. I went down and got it. I hit like a 2-iron out of left center field.
Smacked
and I
it.
Took my time around the bases looking at him all the way, walked across home plate, pointed my finger and said, I'm here too. And
wow.
I walked toward the dugout and the guy said to me, man, you crazy, that Bob Gibson, later for Bob Gibson. Next time I came up, first two pitches right at my head, but I was too quick. I was too quick. They took him out of the game. But there I said, maybe I belong. If I can hit Bob Gibson.
Yeah.
You know, and that's who I wanted to be.
Yeah. And it kind of gives you that, almost like that courage, like, I got this now.
Yeah, because you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know. I mean, when I told you, Willie Mays first hit me the ball in the outfield, and I caught it, I tried to be cool, but I'm kind of shaking. Willie Mays
that's
did
Willie
that.
Mays.
I caught Willie Mays and stuff.
Oh, man, that's so good.
Things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to watch, Jared, I used to watch guys who were successful on the field, but also handled the game with, I don't know, aplomb, dignity, even if when times were tough.
Yeah.
And I would try to glean or take the best from all of these different people. And even the techniques, there were about a dozen guys that I grabbed. I'm going to use that for balance. Oh, I'm going to use what he has for mental focus, mm-hmm. not wasting any at-bats. Oh, I'm going to use this for, he treats this like a science. You know, when I see a Lou Brock he broke the all-time stolen base record. He's 35 years old in hot St. Louis, 110 on that hot surface. I said, they got a knowledge of this game I have to acquire. So there were about a dozen guys, and it took me about 10 years to put all of this together by the first half of my career, I knew how to manage my own body, my own mind, my own state of play.
Yep.
Where I didn't need someone in my ear all the time. You need to do this. You need to do that. That's wrong. I went by what's right.
Yeah.
How can I keep replicating or duplicating the techniques and fundamentals, mental approach to consistently play at a high level? Yeah. And it took me about a dozen years and about 10 years and about a dozen guys.
How crazy is it now that you see the travel? I mean, how was the travel schedule back? I mean, when you came in, you flew commercial, right?
Yeah.
A lot of buses, commercial.
Oh, man, see, people are going to say, how old is he, man? Ray Kroc, the guy that owned McDonald's, that started McDonald's, owned the Padres. He bought it after the first year when the first guy went bankrupt.
Okay.
He bought the team. They said, he's got his own plane. I said, oh, man, we good now.
Got this.
He had a propeller plane, they called some kind of jet. We took trips. I'm going to tell you, it was funky.
But
it was just the way it was. We didn't know any better because there wasn't anything better. We would finish a doubleheader after in Montreal after a two-week road trip, you know, Philadelphia, St. Louis, Pittsburgh or whatever, all these AstroTurf fields, you know, your back is killing
1,000 degrees outside.
Yeah, and so we would finish a doubleheader. After we fueled up, we'd have to land in St. Louis to refuel and then land in L.A. We're a San Diego team, but we had to land in L.A. because you couldn't land in San Diego after 11, noise restriction. Then you take a two-hour bus ride to get back home, and it's daylight. So these guys don't complain about it.
They have no idea. I mean, we fly on Delta charters in the NBA now.
Yeah.
They have a deal. I mean, you essentially fly in a lazy boy chair every single flight. I mean, you got your own stewardess pretty much, and they bring cereal to you, and you got three or four meals on a plane, and you play cars the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that part of it makes it easier. Landing three times, a two-hour bus ride.
Oh, man.
And you got to play every single day, too.
Oh, yeah. We play twice as many as you NBA guys.
like, people don't realize baseball, the amount of money you make is amazing, but being at that ballpark every single day from noon to midnight, those are long days, man.
Yeah. Well, the guys now are stretching it out more than I think they even need to.
Yeah.
You know, they get there now, they pay, you know, you get your meals at the clubhouse, so guys you get your own meal before you get one after the game. But so they come early and they got the videotape and they look at that at 1 o'clock and then they got two, three batting coaches, so they give me some extra hitting at three. Shoot, we used to have a 7 o'clock game. I'm getting there 4:30, 5 o'clock.
That ain't bad then.
You know,
that wasn't that bad.
But you guys, there's certain things about overworking yourself.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of stuff about that. Okay, so fast forward a few years in your career. Now you sign in New York. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about an 8 or 9 year period where you're talking about making $15,000, $50,000 to making millions in New York City.
Yeah.
Was that surreal? That had to be big time, man, to walk out there and see that and be the highest paid player. I mean, that had to be amazing.
Well, I ended up almost 8 year seasons in San Diego, a little over 7 seasons. And each year I was improving as a player and I would make more money. And quietly avoiding free agency, I was like maybe the third highest paid guy in the game.
Yeah.
But nobody really knew. So I was making my way up the ladder. And when it came time for New York and I got the contract, I smiled because I was one of the first guys with a 10-year contract.
Yeah.
I said, I'm going to be set for life. I'm good. Yeah. I'm good now.
That's awesome.
But then you don't know that all the people and the craziness that wants to come your way, that wants to take it from you, that, oh, man, I could tell you stories, all the craziness of, you know, people, they try to steal your money. They're making claims. You know, you got to fight like a son of a gun. But I survived. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was one of those guys, like, I never know how long the career is going to be. I would feel terrible if I ended up with nothing when I finished playing.
Yeah.
So I fight, you know, you come at me, we're going to fight.
I mean, what was the decision-making factor? Like, why New York? Was there just because of the money? Was it the atmosphere? Like, why?
I looked at a number of teams. Mm-hmm. I was the top free agent on the market at that time. You know, I'd played extremely well, all-star every year. Interviewed some teams. The Mets were very nice, but they were in last place.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to go from one last place team to another.
Especially in New York.
Atlanta Braves, Ted Turner. Yeah. Very nice.
Yeah.
Talking about CNN stock and all that stuff before everybody takes it for granted now. Maybe I should have thought about some CNN. But they were in last place.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I got to win. I get in my career. I want to go where I at least have a chance.
Yeah.
And it wasn't about, you know, they said, George Steinbrenner, he crazy. Don't go. I said, well, I don't cause any issues. So I went there and saw the craziness. And it just... Part of the career.
Yeah.
Part of the career.
You crushed it, man. Absolutely amazing career. Hall of Fame. Now you transition. What was the hardest thing for you transitioning from being probably one of the greatest athletes of all time, collegiately, to being one of the greatest baseball players of all time? Now, what's Dave Winfield post-baseball?
Well, for me, it was pretty easy. Easier than most. I had success on the field, made a lot of friends, mm-hmm. relationships. You know, some people, they can't wait till you get hurt. They said, even though you got a contract, out the door.
Yeah.
You know, don't let the door hit you.
Yeah.
So no, I had a good relationship and I had done some planning. So I was going right into, in school, I studied communication, okay. political science. So I ended up going right into media. I did Fox TV,
yep.
did some baseball broadcasting. So I've done that with Fox. I've done it with ESPN. I didn't start at the time, but I was writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
I was a speaker, syndicated column. So I was kind of in my field. It would, to me, when I retired and I knew I was going in the Hall of Fame,
yeah.
it was like I likened it to going down a ski jump,
yeah.
had momentum, and then... You know, kind of going
right
up and flying from there. So it was kind of smooth for me, but that is not the average career.
No, not at all, man.
It's never, very rarely do we ever have fairy tale careers or post careers.
No.
Am I correct?
No, listen, man. It's scary. It is for a lot of athletes. For me, I got really lucky. I was able to transition right into a front office role. With the Denver Nuggets because of a good relationship that we had. But I think that it is scary because you always think you're going to be able to play forever, and you did. I mean, you played for a whole generation, but you had a plan and you kind of transitioned easy. What would you give advice to, you know, current players to transition?
I think they should start early on talking to people when your name recognition is high and people respect where you are, part of a organization in a city, meet people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would, three things I tell a player or anybody, young person growing up, read, travel, meet new people.
Yeah.
And since you're going to travel and you're going to meet new people all the time playing the sport, read as well.
Yeah.
And one way or another, there's the confluence of all those things coming together is going to prepare you for opportunity. And you never know where it is. All those seeds that you've planted, all mm-hmm. those people you said hello to,
yep.
all those people you did something for their family. And read books. There's a friend of mine, Harvey McKay, who has been a speaker and a book writer, a guy who's well known. He wrote a book a long time ago, not only Swim with the Sharks and all of that, mm-hmm. without getting eaten alive. There's one book, it's called Dig Your Well Before You're Thirsty.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's when I say networking, it's really about establishing relationships
Correct.
And stuff before you need them.
Yeah.
Now, because when you need them, you're looking, you know.
When you cold call people, that's a hard life, man. Like when
he's struggling, man. Let's leave him alone.
When you start cold calling people and word gets around, it is, man. It's a hard life. And I tell people this. I do this all the time. I get up most mornings pretty early. I got two kids, so I get up 7, 8 in the morning, and I'll text 20 people that I haven't talked over the course of the day that I haven't talked to in a few months, and just check on them. Because you never know, like, if I need a reservation, if I need a flight, if I need tickets, if I need this, I'm not just calling them out of the blue. You know, right. I'll go through and be like, hey, man, you know what? Everything good? How's your family? We talk a little bit. But then when I call them, I'm going to say, hey, I need tickets to this. I need this. They feel like it's a relationship that's based on more than just cold calling somebody needed something. I think that's so important, man.
That's a key part of expanding it. But that's how you kind of prepare yourself. You never know how long your career is going to be. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that early on, I know for you, your rookie year, you tore your ACL?
Yep.
You don't know how long a career you're going to have.
Correct.
You don't know how that changed the course of the trajectory of your career.
Yeah.
There was, early in my career, I was scoring a run, tackled me at home plate, it hurt my leg, and then when after the ice came off it, I had what they call drop foot. So that perineal nerve on the outside.
How did you fix that?
Man, it took about a year and a half.
And it came back.
Yeah, I mean, I worked from running in the sand, acupuncture.
Wow.
Resistance exercises, tape that bad boy, you know, like almost like you guys tape your ankles every day for basketball.
But you had to tape it so it stayed up, right?
Yeah. And I had to get through that. And I never knew if it was, they said, sometimes it comes back.
Scary.
Sometimes it doesn't. I said, wait a minute, say that again? That could have shortened my career 18 years. I thought that they had just wrapped that ice too tight. I got up, my foot was flopping.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Oh, man. And so you do whatever it takes to try to.
For sure.
Nothing is guaranteed.
Nah.
Hey, back surgery too. I had back surgery 15 years into this.
Wow.
You know, it just locked up on me. I'm with the Yankees, got a couple years left, and man, I couldn't move. I'd stand up straight. My body was angled. I had to come out here to Curl and Job. They worked on me, got me right.
Yeah.
But I had to talk to Jack Nicklaus about it because he had it before.
Mm-hmm.
One of the San Francisco 49ers quarterbacks, I'm trying to remember. You know, but they said, no, you can come back from it because at least orthopedic medicine had come a long way from the days when my good friend Willie McCovey, he probably had 20 surgeries on his knees. They probably just went in there sideways. Oh, let's see what we can do. You know? So it changed. Yeah. And I played half a dozen years after back surgery.
That's crazy. All right. So we're going to close up here. Your foundation. We'll talk about that a little bit.
Man, I was, simply said, I grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota. A lot of people invested time, money in me. Just because they believed in me.
Yeah.
I appreciated the community. So when I first signed with the San Diego Padres and we weren't making a lot of money, I took $1,000 and we said, we're going to start with my friends and family, the Winfield Foundation, and we're going to, for minority student athletes. And so we created a scholarship and annual dinner. We had the 43rd annual dinner this past year, and a number of minority student athletes have been sent off to college, accomplished things. The mayor of St. Paul was one of our award winners.
Really?
As we speak today. Melvin Carter went to Florida A&M, you know, with the breeze behind his back from us.
So
I did a number of things like that. I did it because people helped me. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a natural thing to do. And when no one was before me and you're the pioneer getting all the slings and arrows, man, what's in it, man? What are you trying to do?
What's your angle?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that it was always about doing for others.
No, I mean, that's absolutely amazing. Dude, I can't tell you how much of an honor this is. I mean, you're such a great person, such an inspiration. And like you said, man, multi-generational. And you're the example of what all of us looked up to. You know, like, and you say that, man, as a young African-American kid, to look up to you and all that you accomplished, and then having a chance to sit here with you and consider you a friend now is really dope, man. It's life experience. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate that. And I told you from the first night when we met, I said, you remind me a lot of my son. You know, educated, knowledgeable, loves fishing.
Yep.
Loves esports.
Yep, he loves esports.
You know, things of this nature.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you guys got a chance to meet.
I appreciate
those shoes you laid on.
Yeah, right. That was cool, right? Yeah. That was cool. It is, man. It's, like you said, man, networking, getting a chance to sit down and talk and just compare stories, and then have a chance to meet your family. I mean, I couldn't be more excited about it, man, and see where this all goes.
Well, keep doing your thing, man. I appreciate today.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate it, man. Dave, I want to thank you for coming on and telling us your story on Rookie Year. You can follow Dave on IG and on Twitter at Dave Winfield, H-O-F. I'm your host, Jared Jeffries, and you can follow me on IG and Twitter at Modern Fishing TV. Thank you for listening. Thank you to DCP Entertainment. Listen and subscribe to Rookie Year on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows. For more information, go to dcpofficial.com.
Next time on Rookie Year, Willie Rofe.
I'm the first Louisiana player ever drafted in the first round to the Saints, not from LSU. I want to say that. And then, and then Jim Finks, I was the last player he drafted in the first round, and he died. And I never got a chance to meet the GM that's in the Hall of Fame because he passed away. But I'm his last first-round pick. So what happened was in 92, they started breaking up the Dome Patrol. They traded Pat Swillen, who was Defensive Player of the Year, a linebacker. In 91, they trade him to Detroit and trade up to the eighth pick. And then they got a fourth-round pick. So with the eighth pick, they took me. And in the fourth-round pick, they took Lorenzo Neal. And the 20th pick, they took Irv Smith. So that's what happened, man.